Hello, welcome to episode 21 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, a bored man has got access to a microphone and will use it to be wrong on the internet. I am that bored man. My name is Graham Lee. So in the last episode, I was kind of setting the scene for the PhD that I'm doing, which is about the difference between software engineering practice in commercial and research software contexts. And I was kind of setting the scene by saying that there hasn't really been a whole lot of engineering in software practice at all. There hasn't been a lot of research into process improvement, and I looked into why that might be. Perhaps it's because there's so much money in commercial software that there's no impetus to get better at it. Perhaps it's because the way in which we now tend to run projects on a sort of agile footing with early and continuous releases masks failed projects. There's no such thing as a failed project anymore, because a failure is one that runs for months and doesn't ship anything. Well, now we ship in week two or week one, or even on day one with an MVP, and so there's no way to say that a project went for ages without doing anything. It definitely did something. It definitely shipped something. And you might find very early on that doesn't have value to your customers, and so you pivot. And therefore, you're always restarting bad projects, and you're never actually improving your software engineering processes. So let's look more that tension between agile and engineering practice, because if we look at the sort of formative era of agile, it was very much practice-led and technically led. Particular frameworks like Alistair Coburn's Crystal or Kent Beck's Extreme Programming came from a software practitioners context. These were people who, as they said, were developing software and helping others to do it, and they were a collection of technical and project management, or at least work management practices, that were conducted by a single team who shared ownership of those practices and of the software that they created as a result of doing it. They were optimized for looking forwards rather than backwards. They were optimized for building the next thing that the customer wants, whether that's the thing that they previously told you they wanted, or rather not necessarily the thing that they want next, but the thing that they most value, would be most valuable to them next. And it can be difficult to tease those things apart. Now, in his most recent book, More Effective Agile, Stephen McConnell, who was the author of Code Complete, second edition of Rapid Application Development, and of a number of books that were more focused on sort of taking, if not a fully evidence-based approach to software engineering, then at least one that learned from what had been written and from what various experts were talking about. In More Effective Agile, he said that Agile had kind of shed all of its technical practices in settling on the form that it has today. And I think that's more or less right. If you talk to people now about what Agile practices do you follow, or what Agile practices are common in your company, they will often talk about Scrum or Scrum Butt practices, which is to say, Scrum Butt is we follow Scrum, but we don't do these things because we don't see the importance of them, or they don't make sense in our context, or whatever. So it's the work management practices, the things like having a backlog, having a product owner, having a Scrum Master, having weekly or fortnightly or monthly retrospectives, having sprint planning, organising the work into sprints, those kinds of things. But they're typically carried out by dedicated work management people. So it's almost like everybody who was in a project office in the old days of software project management has now found themselves new roles in the new agile world of being perhaps the facilitators, perhaps the bureaucrats, but definitely fair to say the administrators of the new agile workflows, and the kind of owners of them as well. So, things that XP talked about, like pair programming or having a system metaphor, these are no longer necessary in order to, be capital A, double quote fingers, agile. So these practices are owned by the work management people or the project management people or the product owners or whatever you want to call them. They're not owned by the delivering people. They're not owned by the the people who, in the context of that other great buzzword in software work management, DevOps, they aren't managed by the people who are developing or who are operationalizing the software. So you have a conflict. Have the conflict that the people who are developing the software have these sort of software engineering practices that are about the sustainability, maintainability, and adaptability of the software. And they want to produce something that's high quality, long lasting, where it's going to be possible to respond to change in the future, but who take no interest in understanding what the future is, of understanding what changes are likely, because we're agile, we respond to change rather than following a plan. The kind of future proofing where we try to predict the future sounds like having a big project. It sounds like a waterfall idea. If we claim that we know what we're going to be doing in a month's time, then we're not surfing the wave. We are actually planning for a future that we would rather see. But the people on the other side, the people who actually own the work management practices, so the sort of scrum masters, product owners, the sort of project folks, they're optimizing for fast change. By which I think what they really mean is the fast change of the priority order in which stuff they've already thought of will be added. So, this is where we get the idea of grooming the backlog. They're building these large wish lists of features and then trying out on various customers, would you rather have this or this? And bubbling the higher priority things to the top. Now, of course, there's also the things that politically would go over better with the execs, or the pet features that particular people want or don't want, and maybe biased views of which customer or account it would be good to get onto the books, and so these things are not always objectively prioritized. But they are optimizing for very quickly changing the state of the system, by which I'm pretty sure I mean very quickly adding new things to the system. And then the engineering practices that we've developed, particularly the people who use the phrase, and I'm going to get my double quote fingers out again, reason about code, are deliberately trying to hang on to, understand and adapt the existing set of code and build longevity practices into it. So there's my conflict, is that development practice has become about ossifying, about looking to the past and about saying, how do we sustain this thing that we have already built? While the work management practices are forward looking and forgetful of the past and say, right, what is the next thing that we need and what is the fastest way for us to get that thing? So we've got two groups of people who according to the manifesto and according to their internal mission statements, assuming that they've written anything down, because obviously we value working software over comprehensive documentation, which means that we don't value documentation at all. But if you ask them, they're all on the same team. It's a self-organizing team where everybody has input into the process, but in fact they're pulling in different directions. The engineers are trying to build things that they can reason about, can understand, and have longevity, and so are building a legacy, even though they would probably be the first people to bristle at the use of the word legacy. And the work management people are trying to pull for rapid change, by which I typically mean rapid addition. I think that the only way for everybody to win is to optimize not for reasoning about code, but to optimize for discarding code. To optimize for a practice that maybe isn't what we now call refactoring, but that genuinely is refactoring. That we say, okay, we know what we need the software to do because we've encapsulated that in our tests, and we know what we need the next software to do. So, because this is what is coming down the pipe from our sort of work management organizers, our product owners or whoever. What is the fastest way to get something that is compatible between these two things? And in the cases where it's discard the software that we've already written, and then write software that passes our existing tests and our new acceptance tests for our new feature, we should be willing to discard that software. This would be the kind of refactoring that Ward Cunningham talks about in his original article about where he introduces the idea of technical debt. Technical debt isn't the thing that we currently do under the guise of technical debt, which is acknowledge that we are making bad decisions and yet choose to make them anyway. Technical debt is holding on to decisions that were made in the past in the face of new information. It is continuing to accept and to derive value from code that we know is only partially solving the problem that we now have. If we are to throw that away, and when Ward Cunningham talks about technical debt, he talks in terms of hours or days, not in terms of months and months of build up. And this is probably the closest thing that we have to a software crisis now, is teams that are initially very successful, initially able to find a niche that has product market fit, and to exploit that niche, and to either iterate quickly to catch up with their competitors, or iterate very quickly to build out their features from the niche they discovered to something that builds a useful and sustainable business at solving problems that our customers have, but who then get weighed down by what they call technical debt, by which they mean bad practices or bad design choices that were made at the beginning, knowing that they would be paid off later, but that never got paid off later, or just the weight of these bad decisions because they've always tried to reason about and extend their code and never tried to discard the old. So work management people can, if we optimize for throwing away, they can always change direction as often as they want, because every time they do, we just discard anything that's work in progress. And anything that in the shipping product that's holding us back, and build the thing that gets them to where they want to be now. The delivery folks get to stop whining about technical debt, because it's no longer about being given time to pay it down. It's no longer about clawing out some fraction of your time for engineering backlogs or for hardening sprints. It's just about throwing stuff away that you don't need anymore, and about asking, how do we deliver what the customer needs now, rather than how do we take what we currently have and deliver what the customer needs now? How do we keep this legacy that we have built and add to it the thing that these people are asking for? Because it's when you do that that you typically ossify your existing like design choices, your existing software architecture. You're not only saying how can I add to this code, you're kind of saying how can I justify the correctness of this design and yet build in these changes. You often find that bug fixes in existing software don't fundamentally change the design of the existing software to account for the buggy case. They add an if statement somewhere that says, if at this point we're at the juncture where the user would report that the behavior is buggy, then do this other thing that brings the supposedly correct behavior into the system, else carry on with the existing behavior. And so the software gets sort of wartier over time. It gets more and more accretions onto the underlying model, because at every point the developer working on the system has mistaken the map for the terrain. They have mistaken the original model for being the correct thing that needs to be slightly modified to take account of reality, rather than taking reality as the correct thing and updating their design as their understanding of reality becomes richer and more detailed. Now, talking about engineering practice, I think the region of engineering practice in which software engineering practice, that is, in which this is done best, in which the software is designed to be discarded rather than to be modified and maintained, in which sustainability means the ability to jettison our legacy and move forwards, rather than the ability to reason about our legacy and accrete onto it, is the subset of the community that is doing extreme late binding, because their code is easiest to throw away. You know, if you're doing something like actors in Erlang, or objects in something like Ruby or Smalltalk, or if you're doing very, very small and focused microservices in whatever technology, but emphasis on the micro rather than the service. Sort of very small focused components that represent a very, very narrow part of the domain model. Then the killer feature is the ability to throw away any module in your architecture and rewrite it based on what you now know or believe about the state of the problem. It's not about reasoning about the code. It's not about understanding in depth the mental model of the person who first created the code. It's about being able to say, no, this is wrong, let's redesign it, and let's very quickly replace it. And of course, in the case of something like a Smalltalk or an Erlang technology stack, let's replace it within the running system, which you also get from the microservices model. As ever, I'm interested in all feedback you have about topics that we discuss in this podcast. This is very much a podcast for you, the listener, rather than for me, the speaker. So please do send your thoughts my way, GrahamLee@acm.org. You can find me on Twitter, iwaslg, IwasLEG. Thank you very much for listening, and I will speak to you again soon.